Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome back to Masonic Home Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. I'll be trying to enlighten us all over the next hour and a half or so with topics that hopefully will be of some interest to people of Masonic temperament and anybody else out there who happens to value and share our principles, our desire for harmony and to support common purpose, and to make the place, the world, a little better place for all of us to live in. Welcome. This is a special and exciting day. After all, it's the 28th of April, 2013. 119th day of the year. We're tearing into this year in fine style. It's remarkable. Remember, for all of you, we have Mother's Day coming up on the 12th of May. It's always on the second Sunday of May, so that's an easy way of figuring it out. And I hope you're getting your house in order for the solstice, of course. At 5:04 in the morning on the 21st of June. Can't be too careful about that, can we? One of the events that links us with such a distant part of the history of mankind. This month is an interesting month. We have Victoria Day coming up on the 20th of May. It's curious. But let me tell you, I've been reading about what's coming up in the solstice, and of course, like a lot of people, I was thinking that this is when the sun is further from the sun, the earth is further from the sun. Actually, the earth is closest to the sun in December, which is winter where we are, and as the earth travels around the sun in its orbit, the north-south position changes over the course of the year because of the changing orientation, you know, that tilt on its rotational axis. And the dates of maximum tilt of the Earth's equator corresponds to the summer solstice and winter solstice. And the dates of the where they were straight up and down, vernal equinox and autumnal equinox. So we've torn through that. It's a curious time, of course, being disoriented as we all are from time to time. Here's a little bit about what was happening in history on this day. This is the day in 357 when the Emperor Constantius II visited Rome. And this is also the day in 585 when the war between Lydia and Medea ended by a solar eclipse. Ooh, now that's power. So I think we should pay careful attention to what's going on in the universe. And this was the day when King Philip II threw out John without country from France. That was his name, John without country. And this day in 1253 when the city of Utrecht was destroyed by fire. And it was. This is the day when there was the founding of the Shiren Buddhism in 1253. We saw the rights of people changing. In 1376, when the English Parliament demanded supervision on royal outlay. What's going on? Where's all this? Going and why? And this was the day the first volume of Isaac Newton's Principia was published in 1686. So there you go. 1770, James Cook aboard the Endeavour lands in Botany Bay in Australia. So I guess that's ought to orient us a little bit. Who else was born on this day? Let's see, King Edward IV, the King of England, was born in 1442, and the composer Franz Barry was born in 1715. The physicist Klaus Eckhard was born in 1753. Interesting people. It was also the day when King Zog of Albania married Countess Geraldine of Hungary. When Lisa Marie Presley separated from Danny Keough. How unfortunate. Anyway, let's get on with the program today, shall we? I want to talk to you about, and of course, ask for your advice on things that have run across my horizon the last couple of days. Questions that puzzle me greatly, and I do need your help once more. This is, my feeble and humble effort to link the things that have been going on from the past with the direction that we need to take in the future. And I think definition and defining and redefining are enormously important. From days gone by, we have inherited a great deal, something of value that requires great effort to achieve. Sometimes I think the effort is like ascending a great mountain that has such perils. It takes local knowledge and preparation. A challenge so great only teams can attempt it. While my heart and mind are strong, my legs have passed their time. If I attempted the peak, I would eventually be found out to be a liability on that team, I'm sure. I am, however, also sure that there are others in worse condition, blinded by the appetite for acclaim, who will be found out when they put others at risk. I guess I would like to think that my desire to keep everybody safe would bring reason to me. But I also know there will be other people that really won't care. They want to make that accomplishment, whether they're up to the task or not. And sadly, those types of questions have been raised on the sides of Everest about some people that seems to have become quite a tourist haunt. We see some tragedy occurring. And I think rightfully so, we have to raise questions about whether we have to have some qualifiers, not just a whim to do it, or desire, or anybody coming along saying that they have a right. My goodness. Obviously, a right to die seems a bit odd and out of place. Do we have an appetite for great things, or are we too old and past our prime? Do we have strategists capable of the task? Can we find able-bodied brethren able to work at a time on a project that will occur only once in their lives? Cynics would tell us, of course, we do not. Are you daft? Go back to your milk toast and tea, you silly man. Epicureans would tell us there is some evidence to suggest we do and can, but there is also an equal volume of evidence to suggest otherwise. What say the listeners of Masonic Home Companion? If we want to grasp the opportunity of Freemasonry in its fullness, I think, and I hope you share this, we need to pull our organization together to support great ideas. Our collective insight, sense of adventure, intelligence, and confidence is not a flat line. Who is it amongst us to say the level is static, when everything about the craft is vibrant and impressionistic? Yes, I said everything. I put it to you that the level is an average of peaks and valleys. Such is the nature of our order that while some must of necessity lead, we need to find that merit and willingly follow it. A strong core of committed Masons is out there waiting for the opportunity to enhance the history of Freemasonry. Some may even think, as I do, as hard as it is to believe, while there are so many ready to dispute it, that the best of Freemasonry lies in the future. How to do this, I think, is an enormously interesting event. So I want to ask for your advice again today. We struggle to find what the meaning of the order tells us. We are hundreds of years old, and yet in our jurisdiction, a great deal of our study, a great many of the papers talk about and define physical things. Talks about the history in terms of a charter being issued. That's a bureaucratic function. A great deal of import may be associated with that, but at the end of the day, it is what it is, a bureaucratic function, an acknowledgement. Is this what Freemasonry is? Is Freemasonry then a tool? Is that the way we've been using it? Is it a tool that brings us together in social harmony? The socialization, the club aspect of our work. Is it a tool, like a vehicle, like a format that allows us to perform acts of charity? Is that what it is? We seem to be quite careful and prudent in going about our and recognizing our charitable responsibilities. We also root out dissension and tensions and conflict and sort that out. We tend to turn our back on people that bring that kind of nonsense into our lodges. I would say rightly, some people tend to go a little too far and may act like cheerleaders. Everything's funny and giddy. I guess on a given day, I guess I can get into that. But I think if we treat Freemasonry as a tool, then we're likely beginning to understand why we have this sense of decline. Some time ago, I began hearing some older fellows talk about the Freemasonry competing with other events in people's lives. And I thought, I was gobsmacked with that. I understand, going on, you've heard this, the descriptions that there are so many distractions, including responsibilities. In previous shows, programs, we've spoken about whether this is an order designed around retired people that have a time within their control. I wasn't going to say ever that they have more time, because I know a great many Masons retired who are exceptionally busy, giving from the heart, giving of their mind and their time, talents. I can't begin to suggests that there aren't other distractions out there, if that's how you define Freemasonry. If we are social, if Freemasonry is a tool to bring us together in a club function, then yes, I would agree. There are lots of distractions and competitions for us. If Freemasonry is a vehicle, a tool used to channel our charitable resources, then yes, there are other bodies that would, I would say, rightfully compete with us. But I think this also, I think we have a unique challenge, a question here in our Grand Lodge jurisdiction, in understanding what the craft is. If we are saying that it is the tool of if we are saying it is a tool of charity and a tool of social organization, then that speaks to us about the meaning. How do those elements alone ever help us to achieve the primary function of the order, self-development? Influence, the challenge to come together with like-minded men to reveal the principles and ideas that help and have helped people develop character, the idea of the bigger man. Well, if I think we are defining the bigger man as the man who is willing to give, I think that's noble. But I think then, compared to the principled and philosophical notions of character development, then we have made it a process of economy, economics. I'm not sure I want to take that step with anybody. We have the meaning of the order. I have often thought is so unique. There is nothing else like it. And I think we need to come to grips with that. I think the people that are comparing Freemasonry to all these other so-called competitions for our time and attention, they have closed their eyes to the fact that they're that view is a liability to Freemasonry. It distorts the sense that Freemasonry is that plus. And it's that plus, that added ingredient, that additional molecule, that genetic variable that makes us unassailably unique on the face of the earth. Now, this isn't a failing that we haven't developed the study. It's not a failing. This is an evolution. Nobody has failed in the past. We had, our brethren had other priorities, other things to do. Anybody that would say we're pointing out, we're putting a finger in the eye of the brethren that came before us, I would challenge them. That was simply not the point. It's a reductionist argument that somebody would say, because they're over-personalizing this kind of a conversation. We had other tasks in the past, particularly here in a new, very new country with a very new history. We are a blend of cultures, old cultures from other places and other times. And we are proud of that. And that will be indelibly part of our Canadian culture and identity for a great long time. We are more than that. Given that platform, relatively new, We don't have hundreds of years, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of development to pull back on for reference points. So our reference point is fairly new. Give us a chance to catch our breath. Our communities are still coming and going. They haven't been there for 500 or 600 years. I don't know the communities or any community around here that it was established 600 or 700 years ago. None. And yet, anywhere in Europe, I stumble across the things in the fields that tell us about people's lives hundreds and thousands of years before that. We have a history that barely scratches the surface of the last millennium. Well, relative to that, Freemasonry here doesn't necessarily have a cultural plurality that it does in other places of the world, older than us. And it's not age alone. It's the thinking of people, how we come to our understanding of the world around us as people is very much influenced by our individual histories and our collective histories. To think that a country halfway around the world should be able to function as we do and should simply stop the way that they function and adopt our values and our way of thinking is naive. It's ethnocentric. It's ignoring the fact that there are people of different cultures around us that are as unique as you and I, with different outcomes at a different point in their evolution and their histories. This isn't a live and let live. Pressure is in the eye of the beholder. Time is not faster today than it was 1,000 years ago. As much as we might want to wring our hands and gnash our teeth and say it is, it's impressionistic. So is Freemasonry. Impressionist in me suggests that we have this other step to take in the planning, in the climb that we're going to make. An important step. A step that tells us that we need to reassess. Do we have lofty goals? We're still troubling ourselves with attendance. And although we often pride ourselves in being an order that does not recruit, we spend a lot of time discussing that. And to no end. The ebb and flow, I think the appeal is out there. The draw is available to us. But I think we have to rethink how we're going to, how we understand the uniqueness of the order. And I think to do that, we really would be wise to look at meaning, always the meaning. I cannot believe that how often I see the spirituality of Freemasonry described in the negative. What it is not. As a paper that I read that was delivered in Heritage Lodge about a few years ago, I don't think the author is necessarily important right now, but it was talking about Freemasonry not being a religion. Well, we're also not oak trees. It tells us what we're not, but it doesn't tell us what we are. So, what we seem to be is at a bit of a loss. goals that we want to achieve, that we seem driven to achieve, have something to do with this need for meaning. The symbols around us, they're interesting, but the meaning of symbols changes over time. The way we look at them changes over time. So more than ever, I'd like to remind, keep in mind that the order is changing and we are finding our feet. We are beginning to grasp the importance of establishing a firmer sense of the meaning of Freemasonry. This is not something that can be accomplished with a reductionist notion. One meaning? No. This is a great many. There are many paths to character development. Many, many paths. The success of any of those paths is determined in hindsight. The clamor of the ambitious doesn't do it. Never has. Perhaps that's what fueled the discussions in the Age of Reason, in the Age of Enlightenment. Perhaps. I'd like to think so. That's not beyond our grasp today. Never was. It's there in front of us. We have reached this point where we are able to ask ourselves these questions, primarily because some of our other work is done. Oh, we're recycling. You know, we have to cycle our crops. The orbits of urban development and the draw to from the country and the changes in the countryside that have gone on everywhere are continuing around us. Structures built of stone have some permanence. I say some because we know that's an illusion. Mountains are made of hard materials and they eventually wear down. So too is a slab of stone. If any of you recall visiting the seashore, you'll see that. Or see where the winds and grit have, what the winds and grit have done to surfaces, what they can do with surfaces over time. Our sense of permanence is an illusion. So, our task now will need calmer heads to be able to help us define, to open up the discussions, so that we can begin to talk thoughtfully about the meaning of the craft and stretch ourselves out a little bit more about this boyish notion of what we've accomplished. I think we're looking at things in we have to take this whole discussion sideways. Instead of, if there's a pat in the back, I think it's like we've intellectually sat down. We are what we are. That's why I'm moving on with bringing in discussions and readings and material that I think reveal meaning of a time gone past. It's an imperfect little process, but I think I like it. Here, we're going to want to talk to you a little bit about the... what have we got here? I'll tell you a little bit about this country that we live in, and then we'll get into some Albert Pike and Wally Leslie, our favorite, one of my favorite writers. And I want to talk to you about the Canterbury Papers, a little bit about that, for those of you who are fans of Lewis Masonic. We'll get back to, Canada. I want to talk to you about this country. We're comprised of 6 time zones. I want you to try and work some of this into your conversations this week, if you can. This will amaze. We're almost 30 times larger than Australia. So when you look at that in the map, I always thought that Australia was this great, huge. 30% larger than Australia. 30% larger. We're more than 3 times the size of India. They have billions of people. We are 3 times the size of that country. We are 18 times the size of Spain, 20 times the size of Spain, 18 times the size of France, 28 times the size of Germany, 33 times the size of Italy. We are almost 41 times the size of the UK and more than 142 times the size of Ireland. We have the distinction of the longest street in the world, Yonge Street, in the province of Ontario. It starts at Lake Ontario and runs north through central and northern Ontario to the Ontario-Minnesota border, a distance of over 1,178 miles. For those who can't figure out kilometers, it's 1,896 kilometers. And we had that acclaimed by the well-known authority, Guinness Book of World Records, in 1998. Woo-hoo! We have the longest highway in the world. Highway, that was the longest street. Trans-Canada Highway between Victoria, B.C. and St. John's, Newfoundland, is the longest national highway. 7,821 kilometers. Mm-mm-mm. We have the longest coastline. 202,080 kilometers. We have the smallest railway, the Thousand Islands Railway, which ran in Gananoque, Ontario, is North America's shortest railway. It's 5.43 kilometers. We like big things, we like small things. We have the longest tunnel on the continent, CP's Rail 14.5 kilometer tunnel along Mount McDonald in the Rogers Pass, British Columbia. 14.5 kilometers. That's a lot of work. We have the world's largest, longest freshwater beach. Wasaga Beach, or Wasaga Beach in Georgian Bay, is the world's longest. It is 14 kilometers of beach. So 14 kilometers. And on May 24, it'll be packed. Millions of people coming. Lots of fun. We have the oldest national park at Banff. Province of Alberta. That was established in 1885. That was a stroke of genius, I think. We have the largest Sony big screen inside the Rogers Center. It is 10 meters by 33.6 meters. The world's famous BlackBerry smartphone was developed at RIM in Ottawa and in Waterloo. Canadians consume more macaroni and cheese than any other nation on earth. Why not? There haven't been mail deliveries on Saturday in Canada for the past 35 years. I remember that. Canadian James Naismith invented basketball to give his phys ed students at the YMCA in Springfield, Massachusetts, an indoor team sport to play during the long winters. We have Canada's weirdest club. It is said to be the Sour Toe Cocktail Club. For those of you who have visited Dawson City, Yukon, where you can have a drink, knock back one with a real toe in the bottom. Club motto, if you drink it fast, you can drink it fast, you can drink it slow, but the lips have got to touch the toe. I thought a few years ago somebody knocked it back and swallowed the toe and it had to be replaced. But that's the kind of gossip that goes around Yellowknife if you're in a pub there. In 1962, Pincher Creek, Alberta, experienced the fastest, biggest temperature change ever recorded in Canada as a result of a Chinook. You know, that's that warm air that comes off the mountain. Temperature rose from minus 19 to plus 22 in just 1 hour. We are a strange, strange little country. Minus 19 to plus 22 in an hour. Can you imagine? You couldn't even get your boots off that fast. Unbelievable. Well, we're going to get into a little talk a little more. There's nothing little about Albert Pike. I want to freshen us fresh in our memories about utilitarianism, so you can work that into your philosophical discourse over the next week. But before I do that, for those of you who are building your libraries, you might want to check out the Canterbury Masonic Research Center. That was founded in 1998 as a charitable trust in order to provide a unique environment for the study of research of all aspects of Freemasonry, together with allied traditions, and to make the same available to the public. And it fosters, it has learning programs, public lectures, seminars. Hey, there we go. Sankey lecture is a public lecture. And it has a program of seminars and conferences. But what it strives for is not to fill in or good enough. You know, that often worn-out Masonic notion, it's good enough. Well, they try to actually improve the standards. So they operate at the higher standards of interdisciplinary and comparative scholarship. Now, those are notions that I think I know that we're going to have some people put off that don't have much formal education, but this is the 21st century, and formal education is really a key to a great deal of opportunity for people. So it's not about pushing other people aside. It's, I think, for our order, a matter, question of feeling that you have a place. Whether you are formally educated or not, the mind is not governed. Creativity is not governed by the classroom. Formal education is the discipline that we need. Take a bunch of people. Take the Leafs 15 years ago. Discipline did not occur. Take the Leafs today. Discipline occurs. So I know that's being a bit glib, but without some kind of discipline, we have chaos. Formal education is simply that. And for those that think that it takes away from creation, I think it gives as much as it. If anybody can prove that it takes it away, I think it gives far more. Canterbury Masonic Research Center is housed in the Canterbury Tower. It's in London. That was built in the 16th century, and it was built by William Bolton, a prior of the canons of St. Bartholomew's. And it's still a landmark in London. And it's been, that's where many philosophers and writers and scholars lived there, including Francis Bacon. Now, there is an interesting guy. Now, every couple of years, the college, the Canterbury Masonic Research Center holds these conferences, pulls together papers, and they print them up. The one that I have in front of me here is Volume 4 of Canterbury Papers, and it's called Seeking the Light, Freemasonry, and Initiatic Traditions. So I'm not going to get into all of that today, but I will mention that just coincidentally, this was published in 2007. Coincidentally, a Canadian is included in this, Dr. J. Scott Kenny. He's from Memorial University. And Scott and I are, Professor Kenny and I spoke a couple of weeks ago. And his article in here is Ritual Actions and Meaning Among Freemasonry, a Sociological Approach. So perhaps in another program, I'll talk to you about that. So this one that I have is the fourth in a series of publications produced by the Research Center. And this is a collection of the papers delivered at the annual international conferences held in Canterbury Tower. And that's in Islington, London, for those who know. And there were 11 papers presented at that conference in 2005. And it was, and it has a foreword by one of the a person that just to my mind is the foremost authority in Freemasonry, Professor Andrew Prescott. I understand we're going to be seeing him in a couple of weeks in Edinburgh at the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry. So you can see between these organizations that there is a great deal of interest. I can tell you, I'll give you a sample of what the scholars of the world are saying about us. And yeah, I do think the scholars have more information about us today than we do. Everything from Freemasonry as an instrument of initiation, baptism and Masonic initiation, comparisons and contrasts, secret societies and Western esotericism, from immortality of the soul to symbolism of the cross, ritual reform in the Dutch Order of Freemasons from 1865 to 1906, two distinctive 18th century Yorkshire forms of initiation, burlesquing the Brotherhood, entering the courts of heaven, rituals of initiation in late antiquity, the first Rosicrucians. This was delivered by Tobias Churton. And his book, Freemasonry, The Reality, is one that I think you should put on your library list as a must-have. And then, of course, by Professor Kenny, Ritual Actions and Meaning Among Freemasons, A Sociological Approach. And Philip Carr Gomme wrote Opera as Initiation, the work of Sir Michael Tippett. And then the last paper delivered was by Pauline Chamakin, Seeking Enlightenment, Initiation, and Ritual of Oriental Candidates. So that gives you a bit of an idea of the topics that are that have appeal to the scholars in 2005. It's not to say that we should be doing the same, but you can see that they are paying careful attention. And when the scholars talk, they tend not to hedge their comments. Now I'm just going to move along here, and I'll give you a little bit of a second to listen to something. This will seem interesting on a sunny day, but it's a beautiful song. By the same band. That's the Incidental Music band that that did Worcester and Jeeves, for those of you who are fans of English situation television shows. I'm going to talk now about from Morals and Dogma, and bring us up to date taking a more careful look at the writings of Albert Pike, and a boy that I think I would really much like to have known. This is quite an unusual and an exceptional thinker. I can only imagine that he was not necessarily popular with a lot of people of his time, particularly the button-down and pious. These are people that tend to frighten liberal and free thinkers, and I would like to think that of anything, Freemasonry was predicated on that notion. But as Dr. Seuss said, don't cry because it's over, smile because it happened. Now remember that in the last time we picked up Pike's work, he was talking about the nature of man, and he was claiming that man is by nature cruel. So now we're looking at his writings that declare the Abbé Barrault in his memoirs for the history of Jacobinism declared that Masonry in France gave as its secret the words equality and liberty, leaving it for every honest and religious Mason to explain them as would best suit his principles. Isn't that curious? It sort of fits the theme of the program today on spirituality and spiritualism, I guess. Let's go that far. But retained the privilege of unveiling in the higher degrees the meaning of those words as interpreted by the French Revolution. And he also accepts English Masons from his anathemas. Because in England, a Mason is a peaceable subject of the civil authorities, no matter where he resides, engaging in no plots or conspiracies against even the worst government. England, he says, disgusted with an equality and a liberty, the consequences of which she had felt in the struggles of her Lollards, Anabaptists and Presbyterians, had purged her Masonry from all explanations tending to overturn empires. But there still remained adepts who, disorganizing principles bound to the ancient mysteries. Because true Masonry, he says, emasculated, bore the banners of freedom and equal rights, and was in rebellion against temporal and spiritual tyranny, its lodges were proscribed in 1735 by an edict from the States of Holland. In 1737, Louis XV forbade them in France. In 1738, Pope Clement XII issued against them his famous Bull of Excommunication, which was renewed by Benedict XIV. And in 1743, the Council of Bern also proscribed them. The title of the Bull of Clement is the condemnation of the societies of conventicles de liberi muratori, or for the French Masons under, or of the Freemasons under the penalty of ipso facto excommunication. That means the fact that you were a Mason, you would be excommunicated without due process. The absolution from which is reserved to the Pope alone, except at the point of death. And by it all, bishops, ordinaries, and inquisitors were empowered to punish Freemasons as vehemently suspected of heresy, and to call in, if necessary, the help of the secular arm, that is, to cause the civil authority to put them to death. Also, false and slavish political theories end in brutalizing the state. For example, adopt the theory that offices and employments are are to be given as rewards for services rendered to party, and they soon become the prey and spoil of faction, the booty of the victory of faction. The leprosy is in the flesh of the state. The body of the Commonwealth becomes a mass of corruption, like a living carcass rotting with syphilis. Don't spare us here, Albert, to say it like it is. Man, all unsound theories in the end develop themselves in one foul and loathsome disease or other of the body politic. The state, like the man, must use constant effort to stay in the paths of virtue and manliness. The habit of electioneering and begging for office culminates in bribery with office and corruption in office. A chosen man has a visible trust from God, as plainly as if the commission were engrossed by the notary. A nation cannot renounce the executorship of the divine decrees, as little can masonry. It must labor to do its duty knowingly and wisely. We must remember that in free states, as well as in despotisms, injustice, the spouse of oppression is the fruitful parent of deceit, distrust, hatred, conspiracy, treason, and unfaithfulness. Here we go. We must remember that in free states, as well as in despotisms, injustice, the spouse of oppression, is the fruitful parent of deceit, injustice. Even in assailing tyranny, we must have truth and reason as our chief weapons. We must march into that fight like the old Puritans, or into the battle with the abuses that sprung up in free government, with the flaming sword in one hand and the oracles of God in the other. The citizen who cannot accomplish well the smaller purposes of public life cannot encompass the larger. The vast power of endurance, forbearance, patience, and performance of a free people is acquired only by continual exercise of all of the functions, like the healthful physical human vigor. If the individual citizens have it not, the state must equally be without it. It is of the essence of a free government that the people should not only be concerned in making the laws, but also in their execution. No man ought to be more ready to obey and administer the law than he who has helped make it. The business of government is carried on for the benefit of all, and every co-partner should give counsel and cooperation. Remember also, as another shoal on which states are wrecked, that free states always tend toward the depositing of the citizens in strata, the creation of castes, the perpetuation of the jus divinum in office and families. The more democratic the state, the more sure this result. For as free states advance in power, there is a strong tendency toward centralization, not from deliberate evil intention, but from the course of events and the indolence of human nature. The executive powers swell and enlarge to inordinate dimensions, and the executive is always aggressive with respect to the nation. Offices of all kinds are multiplied to reward partisans. The brute force of the sewerage and lower strata of the mob obtains large representation, first in the lower offices, and at last in senates. And bureaucracy raises its bald head, bristling with pens, girded with spectacles, and bunched with ribbon. The art of government becomes like a craft, and its guilds tend to become exclusive, as those of the Middle Ages. Political science may be much improved as a subject of speculation, but it should never be divorced from the actual national necessity. The science of governing men must always be practical rather than philosophical. There is not the same amount of positive or universal truth here as in the abstract sciences. Hey, Al, we should talk. What is true in one country may be very false in another. What is untrue today may become true in another generation, and the truth of today be reversed by the judgment of tomorrow. To distinguish the casual from the enduring, to separate the unsuitable from the suitable, and to make progress even possible are the proper ends of policy. But without actual knowledge and experience and communion of labor, the dreams of the political doctors may be no better than those of the doctors of divinity. The reign of such a caste, with its mysteries, its myrmidons and its corrupting influence, may be as fatal as that of the despots. 30 tyrants are 30 times worse than one. Moreover, there is a strong temptation for the governing people to become as much slothful and sluggards as the weakest of absolute kings. Only give them the power to get rid, when caprice prompts them, of the great and wise men, and elect the little, and as to all the rest, they will relapse into indolence and indifference. The central power, creation of the people, organized and cunning, if not enlightened, is the perpetual tribunal set up by them for the redress of wrong and the rule of justice. It soon supplies itself with all the requisite machinery and is ready and apt for all kinds of interference. The people may be a child all its life. The central power may not be able to suggest the best scientific solution of a problem, but it has the easiest means of carrying an idea into effect. If the purpose to be attained is a large one, it requires a large comprehension. If the purpose to be attained is a large one, big goals, big projects, it requires a large comprehension. A lot of people need to understand. It is proper for the action of the central power. If it be a small one, it may be thwarted by disagreement. I think that happens all too often, don't you? Our ideas are small. A little bit of disagreement goes off the tracks. A little bit of a beacon that the ideas that we're working with are not suitable to the scale of our abilities. If it be a small one, it will be thwarted by disagreement. It may be. The central power must step in as arbiter and prevent this. The people may be too averse to change, too slothful in their own business, unjust to a minority or a majority. The central power must take the reins when the people drop them. It's like we need rules to help us to understand when there is an injustice and whether it's toward a minority position or whether there's an injustice toward the majority. France became centralized in its government more by the apathy and ignorance of its people than by the tyranny of its kings. When the inmost parish life is given up to the direct guardianship of the state, and the repair of the belfry of a country church requires a written order from the central power, a people is in its dotage. Men are thus nurtured by imbecility from the dawn of social life. When the central government feeds part of the people, it prepares all of us to be slaves. When it directs parish and country affairs, they are slaves already. The next step is to regulate labor and its wages. There's nothing easy about Albert Pike. It's pâté, remember? It's to be taken and savored in small, small amounts. It's that glass of 15-year Macallan. It's not to be drunk, taken for intoxication. It's to be experienced over conversation. Or that freshly ground coffee, or that special tea, or that well-aged bit of steak, or that freshly taken wild turkey. It's not something you would prescribe every single day for most people, but it's wonderful. Those are wonderful experiences. And that's perhaps what we hear from Pike. Now, take away what you can from that. What's he telling us? That if we have problems, for me, it seems like it's our own doing. We've been slothful and indolent. that we need to keep our authority accountable, that we need to, if we have big ideas, we need to share them. If we want change and we don't like what's going on, there are political processes that will help us to achieve that. So, too much of a pike is not a good thing, because there is too much of a pike. The ideas are just, it's like a concentrate. And we're not close to getting into his work on degrees. That is absolutely fascinating when we actually examine meaning. So we're going to switch gears just a little bit sideways with Walter Leslie Wilmshurst's book, The Meaning of Freemasonry. I'm always, this is a book that is just wonderful to go through. When you have a bit of time and you can sit back and sort of sigh at the insights and think about them. And this is a book that I think requires two or three readings. The first one is the emotional reaction to what he says. The second is the beginnings of understanding what he says. And the next is digesting and being able to have those ideas influence your own. So we're going to talk a bit here about, remember, he's talking about the context of degree. So here we're talking about the ceremony of our first degree, then, in comparison to other degrees, is a swift and comprehensive portrayal of the entrance of all men into, first, physical life, and second, into spiritual life. I think a lot of Masons are left with the notion that we're talking about the beginning, the middle of life, and the end of life. In the corporeal sense, the physical sense, I rarely hear it brought out that we are it also embodies the notions of spiritual development. And second, into spiritual life. And as we extend congratulations when a child is born into the world, so also we receive with acclamation the candidate for Masonry who symbolically is seeking for spiritual rebirth. It suggests that we need to prepare the candidate before he walks through the door somehow. Not that we would take away from the uniqueness of what is going to take place. Of course not. It's ridiculous. But rarely have I ever heard anybody even offer the kindest and thoughtful gesture of telling the man that when he walks through this door, everything is symbolic. Everything contains messages. Nobody even does that courtesy. I think maybe we approximate the seriousness of that with some lodges that have the room of reflection, where a fellow is left to his own thoughts, to a period of contemplation before entering the lodge. Lodge of Strict Observance seem to have embraced the importance of that, the contemplative mind. That, for anybody out there listening, I've apologized many times, because I do believe that we are by nature an order of contemplation. And we are not a social fraternity as much as we are a contemplative group that come into the order with our minds open to understanding. But how we do that, the workman approaches that question different than the scholar. But each has an ethical and moral right to experience Freemasonry and what it can offer to help them achieve those goals. Herein, we receive with acclamation the candidate, symbolically seeking rebirth spiritually, and herein we emulate what is written of the joy that exists amongst the angels of heaven over every sinner who repents and turns toward the light. This, are we talking about this notion of redemption? Excuse me, but the theologians don't just swallow this without raising questions. There is debate, as there should be. The first degree is also eminently the degree of preparation, of self-discipline and purification. It's a degree of promise. It's a degree of inspired promise that the answer, whether it's put forward naively or not, is almost available. The answer is within the order, and somehow within the ritual. And the first degree has that sense of value. It corresponds with that symbolical cleansing accorded in the sacrament of baptism, which in the churches is, so to speak, the first degree in the religious life, and which is administered appropriately at the font near the entrance of the church, even as the act itself takes place at the entrance of the spiritual career. Now, that is a narrow assessment, and it speaks to only one way, one particular view of the divine. So take that for what it's worth. It's as legitimate, given all those limits, as any other view of the divine. In the schools of the mysteries, where when aspirants for the higher life were wont to quit the outer world and enter temples or sanctuaries of initiation, prolonged periods were allotted to the practical achievement of what is briefly summarized in our first degree. We are told 7 or more years was the normal period, though less sufficed in worthy cases. The most severe tests of discipline, of purity, of self-balance were required before a neophyte was permitted to pass forward. And a reminiscence of these tests of fitness is preserved in our own working by the conducting of the candidate to the two wardens and submitting him to a merely formal trial of efficiency. It is impossible today, as it was impossible in ancient times, for a man to reach the heights of moral perfection and spiritual consciousness which were then and are now the goal and aim of all the schools of the mysteries and all the secret orders, without purification and trial. Complete stainlessness of body, utter purity of mind, are absolute essentials to the attainment of things of great and final moment. Who, says the Psalmist, and remember that the Psalms were the sacred hymns used in the Hebrew mysteries, who will go up to the hill of the Lord and ascend to his holy place? Even he that hath clean hands and a pure heart, whence it comes that we wear white gloves and aprons as symbols that we have purified our hearts and washed our hands in innocency. So also our patron saint, St. John, teaches, he who hath this hope in him purify himself, even as he, that is, the master whom he is seeking, is pure. For he who is not pure in body and mind, he who is enslaved by passions and desires, or by bondage in the material interests of the world, is by the very fact of his uncleanliness prevented from passing on. Nothing unclean or that defileth a man, we are told, can enter into the kingdom. And therefore our candidates are told that if they have money or medals about them, if, that is, they are subject to any physical attraction or mental defilement, their real initiation into the higher things, of which our ceremony is but a dramatic symbol, must be deferred and repeated again and again until they are cleansed and fitted to pass on. After purification come contemplation and enlightenment, which are the special subjects of the second degree. Aforetime, the candidate for the mysteries, after protracted discipline and purification, enabled his mind to acquire complete control over his passions, and his lower physical nature was advanced as he may advance himself today to the study of his more interior faculties. To understand the science of the human soul and to trace these faculties in their development from their elementary stage until he realizes that they connect with and terminate in the divine itself. The secrets of his mental nature and the principles of intellectual life became at this stage gradually unfolded to his view. You will thus perceive, brethren, that the Fellowcraft degree, sometimes regarded by us as a somewhat uninteresting one, typifies in reality a long course of personal development, requiring the most profound knowledge of the mental and psychical sides of our nature. It involves not merely the cleansing and control of the mind, but a full comprehension of our inner constitution, of the more hidden mysteries of our nature and of spiritual psychology. In this degree, it is that our attention is called to the fact that the Mason who has attained proficiency in this grade has been enabled to discover a sacred symbol placed in the center of the building and alluding to the grand, and the Masons will know. Doubtless, we have often asked ourselves what that phase and what that symbol imply. Need I repeat that the building alluded to is not the edifice we meet in, but is our own selves, and that the sacred symbol at the center of the roof and of the floor of this outward temple is but symbolic of that which exists in the center of ourselves, and which was spoken of by the Christian masters when he proclaimed that the kingdom of heaven is within you. That at the depths of our own being, concealed beneath the heavy veils of the sensual lower nature, there resides that vital and immortal principle which is said to allude to the grand geometrician, because it is nothing other than a spark of God himself emanate within us. Over the old temples of the mysteries was written the injunction, "Man, know thyself, and thou shalt know the universe and God." Happy, then, is the Mason who has so far purified and developed his own nature as to realize in its fullness the meaning of the sacred symbol of the second degree, and found God present, not outside, but within himself. But in order to find the perfect points of entrance to this secret, we are told elsewhere that straight is the way and narrow the gate, and few there be that find it. Emphasis again is laid in our teaching upon the necessity of complete moral rectitude, of utter exactness of thought, word, and action, as exemplified by rigid observance of the symbolic principles of the square, the levels, level, and plumb rule. It's interesting when you begin to look at Walter Leslie, what he's trying to help us understand. He's saying that the insight is there within the teachings of the degrees, but that the opening is very, very narrow and not everybody can pass through it. So I'm wondering, ladies and gentlemen, if what he is suggesting to us is that we have to be prepared to move on, and not necessarily with consensus, because not everybody is able to pass through that portal of understanding, that window of opportunity. So we have some, and when that happens, what takes place? If you can't, or you're disinterested, or you're slothful, whatever the reason, we can't, anyone else, presume that that's the case. It's not like it's wrong-minded of us to suggest that people are silly, or that we're somehow superior because we can do that, or you can do that, or I can't, and others can't. we need to maintain, I think, the focus on our own development and shortcomings and limits and challenges that are in front of us. But it's also suggests that if we take a look at the atmosphere we would be experiencing, that we would be in an atmosphere where some people are distracted and some people sort of get with the program. They understand. They're focused. Well, isn't that what we have today? A minority seem to pass through that narrow opening. The majority focus on the material side, the structures, buildings, things that we can see and things that we can feel. Focus on the social aspects of the order, the fraternal goodwill. A focus on our charitable deeds. These things are important. And there are people that thrive on that. But to ever say that, to compare that and say the totality of Freemasonry lies in any one of those aspects precludes the notion of spiritual development. Perhaps it is the icon of Freemasonry that is the most hidden. That is the most challenging. How do we get our minds around the fact that we are talking about self-development, even to understand what that is? I'll come back and talk about that in another program. We'll talk about how the mind begins to understand self. Is it that the reality that we have around us is about impressions? There's a book out by a fellow named Neil Shubin. It's called The Universe Within, A Scientific Adventure. It's kind of interesting. We come trailing not Wordsworth's clouds of glory, but clouds of primal hydrogen and remnants of a galactic nebula, a fabric of cold stardust and droplets of water more than 4 billion years old. You want to talk about what's going on within? Let's see. Let's take a look at those that need hard fact. Let's take a look. We arrive from billions of years with billions of years of accumulated baggage. We have an internal waste disposal system first developed in a jawless fish more than 50 million years ago, and a body clock determined by the planet's spin as it orbits the sun. Circadians. Spring fades into summer not because that is the natural order of things, but because the same cosmic collision that chipped off the moon and made it our companion also tilted the coalescing planet off its axis of spin by 23.5 degrees, shifting any fixed spot on Earth towards or away from the sun in its annual orbit. The seasons. We see red and marvel at the rainbow because 40 million years ago, in a suddenly cooler, more demanding world, a genetic mutation delivered in some mammalian ancestors the ability to distinguish colors, and with color, the presence of more nutritious foods and fruits. At every scale, we are creatures of the universe we find ourselves in, the incidental product of a whole series of cosmic accidents that opened the way for us as arbitrarily as it ended the apparently inexorable careers of the trilobites and the dinosaurs. And the whole story is recorded, sometimes enigmatically, in our bodies and the landscapes around us. This author, Neil Shubin, S-H-U-B-I-N, it's an interesting little book, take a look at it, laid out a focused version of this thesis in 2008. He wrote a book called Your Inner Fish. A paleontologist who discovered the first fossil of Tlaltec, a preambulating fish, a creature that 375 million years ago dragged itself onto land. We've all seen the animations. Shubin used this find as a marvelous demonstration of the subtleties of evolution through natural selection that preserved and redeployed the fishy inheritance of former skin rather than scales, lungs rather than gills, and hands and feet rather than fins. The universe within is more ambitious. He wants to use the testimony of living beings to tell a story of everything that ever was, starting with the first trillionth of a second of creation, the making of hydrogen, helium, and lithium, the arrival of gravity, the gathering of the galaxies, the forging of 89 new elements, and the supernova scattering of fabric that will eventually become stars, planetary systems, oceans, continents, and people. Surprise, surprise? Not very much. We evolved, so we evolved from the materials available. By the Creator? Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. Even if we were created, we are fashioned from common clay. Dust we were and dust we return. That is to say that it's a book that does challenge. Much of the evidence is still debated, and some of it may never be unearthed. Physics has compiled a convincing history of the universe, except for the first second or so. But we cannot explain why the universe is as it is, or even why it happened at all. Biology and paleontology have outlined a convincing chronicle of life's development and colonization, but the opening chapters are obscure and the beginning a mystery. Primate evolution is an exciting story with missing chapters. But we have no real idea why one species can ask abstract questions, compose poems, and write books about the history of the universe. But even though the direct connections between the wider cosmos and the details of physiology are sometimes difficult to make, this book offers a fresh way of telling the story of life, the universe, and everything. There are delights in every chapter. At the beginning of the 20th century, the exasperated director of the Harvard College Observatory told his staff that he could hire his maid to do their work at half the cost. He liked his threat so much that he actually employed the maid, Wilhelmina Fleming, to examine pictures of the heavens and catalog and codify the stars and nebula. Fleming was joined by other women, and one of the women, Henrietta Leavitt, in 1912, spotted the link between luminosity and periodicity in a class of stars called the Cepheid variables. This became astronomy's first reliable long-range yardstick with which astronomers could calculate the distances to the farthest stars. These distances turned out to be breathtaking. The same discovery led to the realization a few years later that the Andromeda Nebula wasn't a nebula at all. It was another faraway galaxy. The Milky Way was just one of what would turn out to be billions of galaxies. It's the one you and I are in. Receding from each other at every increasing speed. As the author points out, every astronomer is a paleontologist. The light of a distant star is direct evidence of conditions billions of years in the past. Stargazing has become a way of exploring our own ultimate beginnings. Leavitt was employed for 30 cents an hour. There could hardly have been a richer return. Zoologists at Harvard cheerfully hurled a whole bucketful of live frogs one at a time from a five-story building to see if they could survive the impact. They did. This experiment, which would not get past any modern ethics committee, is a reminder that size matters in biology. Being small helps in some ways, and being big in others. It helps explain why species can migrate, can find new niches, can survive or fail and survive to fail and survive cataclysms. The solid thinking on the revelation of the impact of cataclysm and of continental drift and its role in the precipitation of the ice ages, on the discovery of the strange properties of light, on the exploration of the solar systems, and on the odd, almost forgotten adventures of science. One of these was the construction during the Cold War of Camp Century, part of the Project Iceworm, a nuclear-powered city deep in the glaciers of northern Greenland. Glaciers flow, the tunnels were crushed, and the camp was abandoned. But the excavation delivered the first cores of ancient Greenland ice, and these preserved a subtle record of seasonal, annual, and decadal climate changes first used to trace the story of the past few million years. The universe within may not quite deliver on the promise of everything, but digressions such as that illuminate the story of discovery. Best of all, they hint at more discovery and more to be told. The adventure is not over. Check it out. Interesting work. It's always interesting work. Now, you're going to daze and amaze your friends with these facts. You know the act of stretching and yawning simultaneously is called pandiculation. Panda, P-A-N-D-I, culation. The act of stretching and yawning at the same time. So here I am pandiculating. There we go. If corporations founded by Stanford alumni were to form an independent nation, it would be the 10th largest economy in the world, with an annual revenue of $2.7 trillion. The professors recently calculated that. Daylight savings time was suggested as a joke by Benjamin Franklin, who proposed waking people earlier in bright summer mornings as they might work more during the day and thus save candles. Ooh. In 1835, for the first and only time in history, the U.S. had no national debt. Did you know that? Three of Fidel Castro's sons, Alexis, Alexander, and Alejandro, are named after Alexander the Great. Noble beginnings. Sneezing, reaching for a tissue, and nose blowing are responsible for 2,500 car accidents a week in winter in Britain. On the motorway, drivers can travel 50 feet with their eyes closed during sneezing. I'm feeling good. I want to thank you for joining me today and hanging in there. I hope that this stimulated the Masonic genes inside of you. I look forward to joining you again soon. I'm off to an installation in Waterloo on Monday. We're going to be doing a talk on the ancient charges in London at Moffat Lodge on Wednesday. Hope to see you all there. And then we have the Grand Masters banquet coming up in Midland on the weekend. So if you're a Footloose and Fancy Free, that's exceptional. An exceptional opportunity for us to get together and honor our organization. If you are committing racks or acts of random Masonic kindness, of course, I will never know about it. And that's not important than anybody else does. Pull one of those off at least every day. And if you're really good at it, do it as often as you possibly can. There is nothing better in this world than to be able to convince somebody that you're doing something right. So there, I want to leave you with a little bit of music, and I hope that you'll feel a little bit at ease. I'll see you all soon. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for tuning in. 90 seconds left, she says. We weren't on the air last week because of Skype. We just couldn't get on. Don't know why. Anyway. Until next time, Sunday at 8 a.m., the crack of dawn. The day is just spectacular here in southern Ontario. We're looking at 13 degrees. I've got to get out into the sun, and I'll look forward to seeing each and every one of you and greeting you in the flesh.